everybody, and welcome to today's Brexit podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and as we prepare for Article 50 to be triggered and the start of Britain's two-year exodus from the EU, we speak to the lady who forced the government through the High Court to vote on its implementation. Gina Miller is a polarising figure, an anti-Brexit campaigner to some, a lone voice trying to uphold parliamentary sovereignty to others. She joined us for episode 9 last year to explain why she was taking a stand against Theresa May's government, and as Brexit gathers pace with a raft of new bills needing to be passed over the coming months, she has no intention of letting up. What's also clear from this interview is that her life has been completely transformed in the past 6 months as she thrust herself into the spotlight. Thanks again for listening. Please let us know your thoughts by visiting the website brexitpodcast.com, and please do follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Now over to Gina. Enjoy the interview. And a warm welcome to our next guest, Gina Miller, back on the Brexit podcast. Hi, Gina. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Good. Yeah, thanks for coming back again to speak to us. The last time you were on, you spoke to my colleague, Jennifer Hahn. And this was when you were actually taking a government to court over to have a vote on the implementation of Article 50.
Yes.
Now, it's going to be later on this week that Article 50 is now triggered. You are happy that sort of parliamentary sovereignty was retained in that process as you won that court case?
Well, I'm from the point of view of ensuring that our system, our constitutional system of parliamentary sovereignty is intact, I'm delighted that the courts ruled in my favour. However, I'm extremely disappointed that having worked hard and invested time, money, energy, my safety into putting them back at the centre of where they rightly should be, they voted basically against themselves and just became a rubber stamp. So I'm very disappointed in the lack of courage that the MPs and a great number of the MPs appear to show.
Yeah, because you said that you certainly considered taking the government back to court. There was obviously the case where there was two amendments that were thrown out, which was this is one on guaranteeing the rights for EU citizens in this country, and the other one on having a vote on sort of the final Brexit negotiations. Yes.
I don't understand why that was even a debate, because, you know, everyone was talking about it delaying and wasting time, which, you know, it hasn't, but it wouldn't have anyway, because to my mind, one of those amendments was just a morally right thing to do and would not have, you know, tied the hand of the Prime Minister in the negotiation process whatsoever. And the second was just a safety net. It was just literally common sense to put in a parliamentary safety net. So I have no understanding why there was so much resistance in the lower house to putting in those two amendments.
Yeah, you said that they voted against themselves, effectively.
Well, they have, because a meaningful vote was to say that when the package comes back from Europe, the negotiated package, that the MPs would have a chance to talk about every aspect of it, and including saying to the Prime Minister, well, this is not good enough, go back to the table. So that's what a meaningful vote would have meant, to you discuss all the scenarios in both houses, and then there is an act of parliament. Now, they haven't voted to do that, so they've in effect voted against themselves.
And is there any more, for you, is there any more leeway? Can you do any more work in that situation to get that reversed, or is that a done deal now?
No. If it's what I would do is seek to uphold the judgment in my case, which is very categorically that only parliament can take away rights. So if in 18 months, whatever the timescale is, and that package comes back to the UK, to parliament, if there isn't a full debate and there isn't an act of parliament, not just a resolution and a vote, then I would go and seek the court's guidance on this again, because there needs to be, in our view, and there are mixed views on this, and this is why I would go back to court, is that does there need to be a full act of parliament at that point? So there, in effect, would be, throughout this process, three acts. The Article 50 Act to trigger notice to withdraw, the one in 18 months' time, say, which is on once the rights are known, which rights are going to be lost, and the Great Repeal Bill at the end. That's where we think the government needs to be. And if that doesn't happen, then I would go back to court.
Okay. And there's also potentially up to 13 acts of parliament that could take place at the same time as negotiation. Immigration, tax, agriculture, trade, fisheries, all we could go
there
on.
There are going to be many more than that, I think.
Are you going to be, do you foresee yourself being heavily involved in this?
in terms of challenging?
No, I won't, because that is up. I don't. We need to see how the parliamentarians behave. Because if they do hold the government to scrutiny, I mean, they were very effective in creating the U-turn on the budget, for example, for self-employed NI contributions. If the parliamentarians are up to their job, then there's nothing for me to do. However, if they carry on being either bullied or a waste of space, to put it in the, just, you know, let's call a spade, then I would say that there needs to be, not just me, but lots of other people need to be doing that job of scrutiny. We cannot allow a government and a handful of ministers, the executive, to be the power, hold the power in this negotiation process, because we need transparency and scrutiny. It can't be their way or no way. There has to be scrutiny. And if ministers and the opposition won't do that job of work, then I think it's down to individuals to do that.
When Article 50 is triggered, that starts a two-year process. I've spoken to many people who don't think that's going to be anywhere near enough for the work that needs to be done. So is there a sense that people, that this government needs to get things through as quickly as possible?
Can I tell you that the reality, I think, is even worse than that, because it will actually be 18 months, but there are already soundings from several EU member states that their domestic needs and situations and elections will take priority. So it could well be that the Brexit negotiation process from their side isn't really starting until autumn to any real degree, when elections are over. And at that time, we will only have about 9 months. So it could be that the government is faced with a 9-month timetable. And that is totally ineffective. There is, you know, if you think about, simple trade deals tend to take on average 5 to 7 years. I mean, I would have thought the most sensible, common sense thing for the government to do is, whilst it's negotiating, is also be looking to implement or negotiate a transitional period. Because remember, even a transitional period will need all 27 member states to agree it.
Mm. So how long do you foresee it going through before we completely out of the European Union?
I think if anybody tells you they know the answer to that question, I think they're lying, because on both sides of the table, no, this is new territory for everyone, not just us, for the other 27 member states, but also remember that's 39 parliaments. So there is, there are an awful lot of parties around the table on this. And just because we think we could ask for something, we're going to get it, is not the way it goes. But I have an even more, if we get back to the law, I have another worry, which is there are a number of ministers who've already said that they would review this process. So there are noises coming out that they would review this process 6 months after negotiations start. And if it looks as though we won't get a good package or a good deal, or and we just leave and forfeit the rest of the negotiated process and start dealing, looking at the new trade deal. Because remember, we can't do both at the same time. You can't be negotiating leaving and the new relationship at the same time. There is a sequential negotiation that needs to happen. That, to me, is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying, because, in Europe, I've been over on a few occasions for International Women's Day, etc., and they're saying, but if you don't ask for anything, we can't give it to you. And this government seems to be set on such a hard Brexit that they're not going to ask for anything. Now, how can that possibly benefit us as a country? I really don't understand this sort of almost fairy-like thinking that's going on.
So you're sort of painting a worst-case scenario that we'd be on terrible trade deals, we'd be sort of on WTO rates,
WTO rates, I have
on,
to say,
yeah.
WTO rates are not actually as dire as some people are painting. It's not the actual tariffs and rates itself. It's the bureaucracy and the administration and the fact that you would have to have checks and borders. It just becomes everything becomes incredibly laborious. So it's not actually about the tariffs themselves. And it's also the fact that we have equivalents, so we probably would be fine for at least a few years. But it is trying to unpick. If I just give you an example, we actually don't have our own airspace agency for flight taking off and landing in the UK or say to America. That comes under organizations that sit under the EU. So that's just one thing we would have to put in place.
Yeah, I understand. You've said that you're you mentioned earlier, actually, you're kind of disappointed as you're a Labour supporter, but you're the only one that's really put your head above the parapet. Who's let you down? Who do you felt should have really backed you up in challenging the government?
I think it should have been cross-party, because I'm very strongly of the mind that Brexit, as we go through this, is not we should leave party politics behind. This has to be about what's best for Britain. And therefore, I would have said, leave your tribalism to one side for a moment. Think of what's best for the country and vote with your conscience. And that's the way I hope that ministers will do, and come together cross-party rather than, you know, look at what happened to Heseltine. You know, they're worried that if they do that, they will be sacked or whipped. But I do believe this should not be about party politics.
Heseltine said he was sacked, didn't he? And he'd never actually had a conversation with Theresa May.
I mean, not only that, he was sacked off the infrastructure committee, which has been going. He has a job he's held for 6 years, and it's invaluable work. Try to regenerate communities around the UK, which are suffering. And for him to have been sacked from that job, it's just spiteful.
The Daily Express has labelled you an anti-Brexit campaigner. Is there any truth in that, Gina?
No, I've never believed that we can cry over spilt milk. It's about how we go through the process. And, you know, I've been fighting on these principles for nearly a decade now, both in the world of finance, investment, pensions, and the charity world. I am a transparency and scrutiny campaigner, because I think it's wrong that people think that they can hold power and to the detriment of ordinary people.
Yeah, in terms of sort of throwing yourself into this, I'm interested in kind of why you're so impassioned. I mean, it must have come as a bit of a personal toll to yourself. You know, you've had threats and protests outside your office. There's a quote from you: I've had letters with the most expensive stationery, beautiful handwriting, and the most poisonous words. I mean, it's a lot for somebody to put themselves through.
Well, I have to say, at the time, I obviously realised I've got a thick skin, and all my work I've realised is back to that. When there's either conflicts of interest or people are very emotionally invested in something, I expect a backlash. That was, you know, expected. I did not, however, expect to be having that every part of my life would be ransacked, and the fact that I have to now live a very different life. You say about the threats, actually, you know, I didn't expect people to be saying I should be a second Joe Cox, that me and my children should be murdered. You know, there are arrests being made. I'm under, my entire life has changed from a security point of view, so of course I didn't expect that. But at the same time, it has led me to believe that if this is a society we now appear to be living in, where people believe that they have been given permission or they feel emboldened to act this way, then I need to speak up even more so. It almost feels to me almost fatalistic that I'm in the position I'm in. I was passed the baton, because remember, this is the thing that the, you know, be it whichever right-wing press you want to quote. I did not appoint myself as the lead claimant. On the 19th of July, at the administrative hearing, Lord Leveson appointed me as the lead claimant. There were six other parties in the courtroom. So I did not make myself, I did not put myself on this platform. The court did.
Yeah, you must have a strong support network surrounding you to keep you, keep you sane, I guess.
Mainly a handful of friends and family, and that's all I need, because I am a particularly strong person, because I think my belief is that it doesn't matter how successful you are. The only things that really matter are your voice and your actions and your conscience. And I've always believed that before I had any money, and then when I became successful. And that's all I'm doing. I'm doing what I believe is right.
Has there been times when you just thought, do you know what, I should just walk away from all of this and perhaps just move away and take your family away and say there's nothing more that you can do here?
Well, I if my safety or our safety and our home is breached in any way, I have had that conversation with my husband about leaving, because I couldn't put them through that. I mean, luckily that hasn't happened. But if that were to happen, that is a conversation we've had. Because at that stage, I could not bring my young family up where, you know, at the moment we don't go out on the weekends, you know, we stay home, I don't use public transport. It's changed my life to that degree, and that's not fair on them.
Sure. You talked earlier about the elections that are happening in the States all over Europe. which are going to take priority over, you know, for those countries over whether, over certainly Britain's role in kind of leaving Europe. Do you see the breakdown of the EU as inevitable ultimately?
This was my argument throughout the campaign leading up to the referendum vote, because I actually refused to be on the Remain ticket. I felt it was too binary. I was arguing for Remain reform and from within and review, because I think there is much wrong with the EU that needs reforming, and I think we could have been the change agents to do that. That's now not going to happen. So I think there's now even more of an elevated possibility that there will be either a two-tier EU or some sort of redefining of the powers within the EU, because there needs to be reform.
Yeah, do you? Which countries do you see sort of following Britain's lead? Mark Rutte won the Dutch elections the other day. In Italy, there's a sort of a far-right party that's gaining some ascendancy. There's obviously elections in France and Germany and
in
stuff
France,
coming up.
Mm.
So, yeah. What are your thoughts?
I think this idea that France would sort of Frexit or leave is, I don't believe it, because if I use my sort of day hat of my investment world, from a macroeconomic point of view, they're a low-growth, high-debt country. And then what would happen if they then got rid of the euro? I don't believe France is in a position, economic position, to leave the EU. However, if Le Pen were to win, it would change the mood music across Europe, and she would seek to change her power base within the EU or where France sits within the EU. So things would change, but I can't see how they could possibly leave the EU.
Sure, unless it was perhaps put to the public vote.
I don't think she would do that. I mean, France is different. France has particular problems that we don't have. They have, you know, the way they've dealt with immigration. They're very secular. They have different issues from the UK. And remember, in the UK, we have had a group of conservative MPs fairly, you know, from the day we went into Europe, they wanted to leave, or they didn't actually even want us to go in. So this is, they've won after, you know, this is something that's been impassioned in a certain element of the Conservative Party for decades. That's not quite the same psyche in France.
Understood. What's next for you, Gina, on this? What battles are you going to be fighting next?
Well, I think we need to see, as I said, Article 50 is absolutely right that it should be triggered. And then we need to see what comes back from, you know, what the Prime Minister's hand is, because she's repeatedly said she won't talk about her strategy. She won't show her hand until the notice is triggered. So actually, I want her to get on to do that, and I wish it was even sooner than the 29th of March, so we can see that hand, because I suspect that there isn't much of a plan. We don't have the resources or the people with experience in place. And then the public, the politicians, corporates, every single one of us has a responsibility to put the government on your notice and say, we want to see what you're doing that's best for Britain.
Yeah, so when she triggers Article 50 later on this week, you don't expect to see a lot more information fall out of that? Just a short
one-page.
No,
one of the things I think will happen, there will also be a white paper on the Great Repeal Bill. And one of the things that they may include in it is the use of yet another ancient power called the Henry VIII Clause.
Yeah, I was
which
going to
would
ask
give
you,
the government power.
What is the Henry VIII Clause? So it's like, is it allows you to behave
quite extraordinary.
Your wife?
Well, I tell you what, it's not far off, but this is the thing, you know, the prerogative power of the Henry VIII. I mean, it is, you were laughing, but this is incredibly serious, because this is a power grab, because we could end up with the Brexit negotiation process empowering the Prime Minister and her executive at the cost of Parliament. And the Henry VIII clause, in its simplest terms, says that Parliament can be bypassed and that you can get rid of primary legislation with secondary legislation. So basically, it's a power grab. And it's not something that has happened overnight. So I'm very concerned about that. And this is not overnight. None of this, you know, the whole vote, people hurting, voting and angry, none of this happened overnight. And there has been a power grab and creep going on in Parliament for years now.
Gina, thanks ever so much for joining us again on the Brexit podcast. Really, I know you're a busy lady, and I really appreciate your time.
Thanks once again for listening to the Brexit podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's interview with Gina Miller, and we really appreciate your support. hope that we can try and bring some clarity to the complex world of Brexit. The Brexit Podcast is produced by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, and Warren Pohl, with theme music from Kevin MacLeod.